how do you survive in a situation where you have no power? And Vashti and Esther are both stock answers to that question. One is outright rebellion, and the other is subtly working within the system. But neither of them are great options, because both Esther and Vashti are faced with horrible choices. And it tells us about what is life like when you're in a situation where, as a minority, as Jews were in Persia, or as women were in this world, what can you do to subvert and overcome things? I think that's one of the reasons why I fell in love with Purim, is its ability to enable me to be more and more homosexual every year. Rabbling on. Rabbiting on,
rabbiting on, rabbiting on. Three rabbits, maybe a guest, doing what rabbits do best. Rabbiting, 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 rabbiting on, rabbiting on.
Hello. I feel like we should pretend that we're feeling a bit the morning after the night before, because by the time you are hearing this episode, we will have just celebrated Purim, a time when we recall the brave and creative ways that people overcome adversity, all memorialized in the reading of the Book of Esther, the Megillah, wearing fancy dress, drinking, singing, shouting, and with the funny-shaped baked goods and noisy rattles. But there's a dark side to Purim too. But I don't think we're ready for that dark side yet. I think it's important to be able to welcome and say hello to my friends and colleagues, Rabbi Robin Ashwastein and Rabbi Debbie Young-Summers, who we rabbit on together frequently. Lovely to see you.
Hello. Ooh. Hi.
And we're here with a special guest appearance from evangelical drag queen, proud homosexual, and student rabbi, Lev Taylor. Nice
Thank
to see
you very Lev. Much. I'm so glad you used that introduction. Just so pleased.
Well, this of all rabbiting ons, really, I'm not sure if we're throwing off our masks or getting into our disguises. It really depends how you look at life. For those who are not just listening to the audio, but appreciating being able to see us, you'll see that we've had a little opportunity to Purim up this week. But I think it's important to be able to say, even for those who are not on YouTube and watching this, what are the masks we wear day to day, not on Purim? I think the pink wig and the blue wig are all very well for Purim, but I suspect in our roles and just as in life, there's a little bit of mask wearing. What would you say the masks are that you wear?
I definitely thought when you asked that question, you meant the face mask. And like, I was like, well, I bought this one. It's not so comfortable. But no, you mean the masks we wear. And we were discussing the famous drag queen RuPaul's philosophy, which is everyone is born naked and the rest is drag. So all the masks. I would say the mask that I wear almost all the time and try really hard to dismantle and get rid of is being a good girl. I have been like playing the act of being a good girl since I was about 2 years old. I feel like I wasn't up until that point, but about two, I cottoned on that that's the way to get away around in the world. For me to act out of that takes a lot of courage and a lot of reflection. So I love Purim because often I choose a character that is not about being a good girl. So that's my primary mask, I would say.
I think this is such a fascinating question. And I think we all have maybe not masks, but hats that we wear at different times that we put on and off to inhabit different spaces and bring a stronger or different part to different things that we do. But when you asked the question initially, it actually took my mind back to about 13 years ago when I lost a huge amount of weight, about 50 kilos. And I didn't realise that people saw me in a particular way when I was bigger and when I was smaller. And so I feel like there's this mask that people see that I don't see, because I'm the same. Whichever body I'm looking out of, I see the same world and I experience myself. My body doesn't bother me, whatever size it is. I'm very happy being a big girl and I enjoyed being slimmer. I achieved what I wanted to with my slimness, which was getting my kids. But, you know, there's this really different way that people in the wider world perceive me differently. So people are much nicer to you when you're slim. And I didn't know that, having lived as a big girl until I was 29. So people would smile at me in cafes and be nice to me in restaurants in a way that they never are when you're a big person. And I didn't realize people weren't nice until they were. And I just think that's so fascinating that what they see is different because what I see isn't different.
Wow, that is fascinating.
I think there was a time when I would have said that I had all these different masks on and I was like constantly slipping between worlds, like between religious Jewish world and gay world and stuff like that. But I think they've now all kind of gradually merged into this one mask, which is actually being a rabbi, which I feel really uncomfortable yeah. with. And like, I'm like a few months away from finishing my studies, and for about 5 years people have called me rabbi and I've always been like, well, you know, I'm not. And now in a few months I will be, and I still feel like I'm not. I feel like it's a sort of a very dishonest mask that I've been you know, that I'm playing this role that I'm not sure I can do very well. So that's my big mask.
That's fascinating also, because I think you feel you're wearing that mask always. I 15 years post putting on that mask and feel like I'm still wearing it for other people. I realize they need you to be in it more than you need to be in it. Because I suspect the mask I wear most is one of trying to be the one that's calm. And I think the majority of the job of being the rabbi is holding a space, being the one that says, it's okay, I've got this under control, and I'm going to guide you through whatever it is that we are experiencing right now. So often that takes quite a mask to be able to put one's own kind of needs in that moment to one side and to make it all about holding other people through whatever it is that they're experiencing at that point.
I think that is so healthy, though, what you've just both said, Lev and Miriam, because the moment that we don't see it as like artistry, what it is to be a rabbi, or that we're doing it for our own need, that's when the abuse and the darkness happens. And we'll get onto that with the Purim story later. And our colleague, Rabbi Daniel Lichtman, always says that, you know, being a rabbi is like putting on a garment. And I think that's so helpful in terms of being able to step into it. And it's not being dishonest, I don't think. I think it's being humble. And I think it's recognizing what other people see and the role of that calm, non-anxious presence that you speak about, Miriam, that often isn't exactly how we're feeling emotionally, but it's on us to like regulate that emotion and to try and see the bigger picture and where the stress is and what the system needs or what people need. It's not a disguise, I would say. It's, you know, it's a garment. It's something that we put on and we play a role at.
Rabbi Daniel is actually a fantastic example of that, because he actually has a rabbinic drag queen character that he yes. comes as sometimes. I think some of you will have seen, I can't remember what it's called, like Hipster Chassid or something like that. His like fabulously dragged up Hasidic character. He also once came to a Purim party that I was hosting dressed in nothing but a white sheet over him the entire time and refused to identify himself. And nobody knew who he was or why he was there. And he just sat in a corner dressed in a white sheet the whole time. And in the end, I went up to a friend and I said, there's somebody under that sheet. Who is it? And she said, oh, I'm not supposed to tell you, but he represents God's absence. I was like, it's Daniel. Now I know it's Daniel.
There's something really interesting in what you were saying, though. I love that story about the mask of being a rabbi. I actually think the title is part of that. And so quite often people say, you know, what should I call you? Is it Rabbi Young Summers? Is it Rabbi Debbie? And my answer generally is Debbie is fine. If you need to use the rabbi, that's also fine. Because for me, the title is a tool that allows me to do the things I want to do. And if people feel that that tool helps them go with me, then that's fantastic. But just as looking out from the fat body, looking out from the title, I'm still Debbie doing my rabbi thing.
Yeah.
And maybe also, you know, the good girl, Robin, trying to push boundaries and trying to change the world is also part of the juggling act that we do. Purim's an interesting one because I feel it has a completely different nature to our other festivals, and not because, you know, we dress up funnily and eat different food. There's something about it which doesn't try and claim something of the other festivals. The other festivals claim a moment in history, take us from one chapter into the next. Purim seems to stand alone much more, in much more of a folklore-y, fable-type place. And I suspect that's why we can take these characters in a different way and really hold onto them in a different way. So should we start by looking at the women? Should we start by looking at Vashti and Esther? And who's the feminist hero? Are either of them the hero of the story?
So I'd like to start with the folklore part of Vashti and Esther, because I think there's something really fascinating that happened for me anyway. I remember taking the Purim story. I was asked to teach at a convent. The Sisters of Zion were running a course about Jewish festivals, and I was brought in to teach the Purim festival. I was a student rabbi at the time, I think. And I started off by talking about the story, and Vashti, of course, is invited to come in to her husband's party, and she's asked to appear naked for their titillation, wearing nothing but the royal crown. And one of the students put their hand up very slowly and said, "Are you sure about that?" It's like, yeah, that's the story. And then we looked at the story. There is nothing about Vashti being naked. And I was a student rabbi and had never noticed that this was a midrash that I had taken. And I think many of us read the story in that way because it's what we're raised being told. And actually, Vashti is asked to appear wearing the royal crown, but it doesn't say she's not allowed to wear anything else. That's a midrash that we've woven into it. We've created this folklore. And I think that in and of itself is so fascinating. Part of the folklore that's developed around Vashti through Midrash is about her asking her maidservants to all do the cleaning in the buff and being quite an abusive employer in order to justify how she's treated. But of course, that also isn't in the text, because what happens is Vashti is asked to do something, she refuses, and her punishment is exile. And I therefore think she is a huge feminist hero for standing her ground and accepting her punishment, even though she loses all her status. Whereas Esther, I think, uses her body and her beauty to be manipulative. And that's maybe what she needs to do. But I think there are questions in there for us as feminists as to where that takes us.
I would really agree with Debbie. I think the question has to start with that thing about what is the real version of the story. And one of the interesting things about Purim is nobody really thinks there's a real version of the story. Everybody knows that it is a comedy written into the Bible. It's not a historical event. There was never a massacre by Jews of Persians in antiquity or anything like that. It's a story that builds in these sort of stock characters responding to a real situation, which is, how do you survive in a situation where you have no power? And Vashti and Esther are both stock answers to that question. One is outright rebellion, which can result in, you know, humiliation and exile. And the other is subtly working within the system. But neither of them are great options, because both Esther and Vashti are faced with horrible choices. And it tells us about what is life like when you're in a situation where, as a minority, as Jews were in Persia, or as women were in this world, what can you do to subvert and overcome things? And one of the things that I like on that theme of mask is one of the answers I think that the story of Purim hints us towards is you can satire and you can make fun of it. And I think both Esther and Vashti in their own ways find ways of turning it all into something that is a bit ridiculous.
I love that reading of it, and that the satire and the humour is where to reside and to find activism as well. I think that Vashti and Esther are also reflections of the first women of Lilith and Eve, aren't they? So we've got the two stereotypes again, that we've got like Lilith and Vashti being the ones who, and if we don't know about Lilith, because she again is something created out of Midrash and retellings of the first woman who again refused to be subjugated by her partner, Adam, and flew away and then was demonized. And all these women have been, violence has been enacted upon them. Esther has, because she was purified, like the early versions of the Book of Esther, she becomes even more pure and kind of victimized in the stories by others. And of course, Vashti is, you know, with all the midrashim that Debbie was talking about, given a tail, you know, really made dehumanized in that way. And my son came back from his school having learned about Vashti with a tail, having drawn Vashti with a tail. Outrageous, because that's what we do. But those are the, how do you, within a system that is fundamentally designed to oppress, which I think is a system we live in, be that through homophobia, transphobia, misogyny, whatever it is, how do you create change? Is it from within or is it from without? And I think like being rabbis is a really, you know, complicated one, because we are within this establishment. So how do we, within the establishment, create the changes that are necessary? Do we have more power within or from without? So I love it, reading an activist, but also having the joy in it, like joy and humor and activism is like crucial, because or else I think you'd lose your mind slightly.
There's an interesting piece around how both women use other people, right? Mm. So Vashti, one of the things we're told, one of the reasons that she is seen as a threat is because she's seen to influence the other women of the kingdom, that she's seen as an influencer and therefore needs to be suppressed in order for her not to be that influencer. Whereas Esther has other people subtly kind of giving her the power to do her own thing and to be kind of upfront, that it's almost as if the worry is that Vashti will push other people forward, whereas that Esther is being pushed forward by other people and being kind of elevated by them. So also an interesting question of how we corral other people into changing and making change.
Yeah, I've got to try not to get so overexcited, because I'm really excited about this topic, because I think I'm going to try and do a PhD. Well, now I'm saying it publicly. I'm going to try and do a PhD, which is about the collective. So about women together. So part of my worry about Purim is that it's funny because the minority and women in this case, you know, succeed, or Jews, you know, Jews and women succeed. And it's funny because it didn't really happen and it never will happen. And especially when it's one woman doing it and like bring, you know, they didn't bring people with them. They acted by themselves in a sense, or were told to act by themselves. And what if you bring the women together? What if we read people together? That's when people start to get scared. And that's when like real change happens, I think, and when it can get threatening and you get a reaction to it. So I'm really interested in what we're doing, which is like our voices alongside Vashti and Eve and Lilith and Esther. Like it's a completely different mind game then, bringing that in. Also, my mum's doing a PhD on the Book of Esther, so I may well have lived with this for like the past 3 years.
I was going to ask if your PhD is a sequel to your mum's.
No. But she's doing great. And she's actually writing a drag, because we're really obsessed with RuPaul's Drag Race, as many of us on this podcast are, is writing a Book of Esther RuPaul Drag Race episode. It's going to be really mega. So, but she's, yeah, I've lived with the Book of Esther for quite a while and she's doing really interesting stuff with it.
That's fantastic. What is your mum's PhD on? What's her proposal?
I'm not going to do it justice, because whenever I try to, she says I haven't got it quite right. But basically, it's changed shape. But it's about what is done to Esther in literature, so 19th century literature. So how Esther, the character of Esther, is used, manipulated, but also kind of interpreted through that. That's, I think, in a nutshell. But I will probably get a text message after this airs going, that's not exactly what it is. Yeah, but it's that, and she's lived with it, and she's really loves it. Yeah.
It's interesting that it takes us into a sort of how the festival has been edited over time. Mm. I tend to find my editing happens when I'm asked to teach children, or when I like within a shul context, or even when I go into worse kind of non-Jewish schools. And we do it every time, right? How do you tell the Pesach story or the Hanukkah story when you're in a mixed environment of a day school, and being able to, you know, not use the word Egypt or Greeks or those kind of things. But how do you tell the story? But we edit Purim all the time.
I mean, I grew up not hearing the last chapter of the Megillah. I didn't know that there was a massacre at the end of the story.
So they just stopped
at the hands of the Jews.
They just stopped at the end of chapter 8 at Radlett.
Think so. Yeah.
That's what
maybe
I had as well. I had no idea that it ended that way.
So, Lev, am I remembering right that there were many liberal communities that actually stopped celebrating Purim completely for
a while?
That's
right. Purim only made a comeback in liberal Judaism between the 70s and 90s. So it was cut out completely because they thought A number of things. Firstly, that this end bit that was glorifying violence against the Gentiles was completely inappropriate. And secondly, that if they were going to be good British citizens, getting drunk and foolish was hardly the sort of decorum that they were trying to encourage in serious, responsible Jews. So we didn't have it. And I really understood why people wanted to edit it. That it's really horrible. But recently, Rabbi Deborah Kahn Harris, who's the principal of the college, taught us a class on Megillah and really drove home to us that because the whole thing is so ridiculous and so comedic, the massacre at the end is really like the end of a Quentin Tarantino film. It's just ridiculous, outrageous gore that makes no sense because it's just part of a ridiculous story. And it helps to reinforce it. I love
that idea of it as Quentin Tarantino type violence, because that is always so ridiculous. The blood spurting out of the arms and, oh, that's really interesting. I love that.
I love that reading and that class. I remember the class with Rabbi Deborah, and it was like one of my favourite ones in the 5 years. But I always get worried about turning away from the violence and apologizing for it, either if we do it historically and go, well, it actually didn't happen, or that it's like, you know, so OTT, which I agree, because the whole thing is a parody, the whole thing is carnivalesque. But we know violence also happens. We know that often anyone who gains power, having been oppressed or for whatever reason, then enact violence upon other people. So I also think that, like, I was going to say, I love the violence. That's not right. I love the violence story. That's what I like, because then I see it in myself and then I'm more open to what is it possible that I might do? Because we all have it within us. It's not, and it breaks down that barrier of like them and us, that those people are violent. No, we're violent. We should feel uncomfortable. We should have that. And what I also love, I told you I got really excited about this, is like we all tell the story of the Megillah and we're cheering. We're like, woo, Mordechai. I go, woo, Esther, like boo, Haman. And it gets to the end of the story and we're still in that, like we're a bit tipsy, whatever, having a great time. And then it's like the massacre. And there's a moment where it's like, I think Mordechai, the name is like Mordechai killed or something like that. And we're all like, woo! And you just realize you've been caught up in the story and that actually you're about to cheer for the, like, you know, extermination of thousands of people. And I think that's so interesting. And we should come out feeling, oh, what just happened there? Did I just get taken along with something that I wasn't wanting to be part of? That's the power of a story. And Purim is like the one festival that is like, here is the power of a story and the way that we can kind of come out anew, maybe.
I think there's a new story as well that I might not have even sort of realized we're now carrying with this story. But I think particularly here in our community, it's something that I'm becoming aware of, which is that Purim was the last thing we did before lockdown 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And actually for a lot of people, it was the cause of a lot of spread and of problems in the weeks to come. And there's kind of this other massacre in a way that we're now carrying at Purim time and holding that sense of what does it mean to come back together and do this? And, you know, maybe actually putting on our masks is part of that. Sorry for those listening, I just put my face mask on. Right, there's a mask thing about this as well. And how do we make sure that we're keeping each other safe in the story of that violence?
There's a beautiful translation within the Siddur that asks God to give us the strength to make peace, which I love that imagery that sometimes the strength to make peace might need violence in order to bring about peace, but sometimes it's the strength to do the right thing, or the strength to stand against the mob, or the strength not to get swept up in the frivolities and lose one's sense. That idea that what Purim teaches is that we need to find that strength in order to bring about a better world. What about some of the other kind of Purim rituals, that which we do on Purim, rather than just reading the Megillah? Any particular kind of favourites or moments that you say, for me, Purim will always be?
So I guess one of the newest things for me that I don't think I particularly grew up with, but living in a community like Boreham Wood, where there are lots of young families and lots of, you know, quite a large percentage of the local population Jewish, so lots of Jewish schools, the giving of gifts of food is a really big part of Purim that I didn't properly grow up with. And, you know, the kids will come home with little goodie bags and we'll have friends deliver homemade biscuits and jam to the door in baskets. And there's this kind of, you know, Hanukkah isn't the time of gift giving, Purim is. And alongside that, of course, we're supposed to give gifts so that everybody can eat. It's not just gifts for friendship, but actually feeding the poor and making sure that everyone can give and everyone gets. And it's a part of the festival I've really come to love, but there can also be something really competitive about it, like this sort of one-upmanship of, you know, how homemade it all is and how well it's presented. And have you thought of something really clever to put it in it? I have to say, the best thing I came up with a few years ago was, is part of my attempt to upcycle everything. I'd managed to turn a load of old scratched vinyl records into bowls by you put them over a metal bowl in a warm oven and they slowly fold and ripple around the bowl. And I served my, what they call mishloach manot, my gifts of food in my little vinyl records. And that was pretty funky.
That is cool. Top we tip. Once had a very upset conversion student from my gateway class who had been given a gift on Purim by a sister-in-law and had taken it to be matanot le'evyonim, gifts for the poor. And she was like, why would she give me this gift? I know you're meant to give to the poor on Purim. Like, does she think that badly of me? Does she think I need this food? And I was like, no, there's also mishloach manot. There's also just gifts for your friends and your relatives and those people that you want to show that joy and that love to. So making sure that both within our circles and external to our circles, we're bringing everyone that joy.
Debbie, can I say how in that story, I love how you hate that there's a competition, but that you are absolutely winning it. I would say for me, Purim is always big Yiddish cabarets. I think of it as just such a festival of all sorts of ridiculous things. And for years, I've been able to go to cool things done by groups like Homos and Hummus, where they put on drag shows and put on cabaret and strip teasers and ridiculous songs. My friend Joseph has a hilarious song called the Purim Massacre Song. You know, there's just loads of like brilliant, ridiculous things that come out of it. And I think that's what really makes it such a special festival. Is that everyone is getting down and ridiculous.
I was going to say that makes my Purim look very boring now. So I obviously need to like, either Manchester needs to up its game and I also need to up my game. I think for me that my favorite thing about Purim, it's kind of obvious, is dressing up. I have always hated dressing up. And until I was a rabbi, like avoided it and did really like boring things for it. Just like put on, and it like did nothing. Partly it was because I was traumatized, I think, by my mum, who for our fancy dress parade, instead of dressing me as one of the characters in the Book of Esther or like the typical thing, dressed me all in black and gave me a calculator and stood me on the stage. And the person, you know, they MC and they go, oh, hello, cute little girl. What are you? And I'm like, Blackadder, because my mum thought that was really clever. And I was like quite traumatized. Kind of now I'm really glad because it was a bit countercultural to everyone else dressed up. But so I've always avoided it. And I think that's partly that good girl thing of like drawing attention to myself and like body imagey stuff, which Debbie was talking about, you know, like just not wanting to be it. And then when I became a rabbi, realized it was part of the role and then decided I'll give myself permission to do what I want. And I think often what I love being able to do is talking to something that is beneath. You can't do it explicitly, but you can do something really subversive through dressing up and what it looks like. So one year I went as King Ahasuerus, which isn't that exciting, but like meant a lot. There was a lot behind it and why I was doing it. I love being able to do things like that. I haven't worked out my costume this year. Last time I went as something from Star Trek, that's just because I like Star Trek. But I love the aspect of getting dressed up. And of course, as my mum was telling me earlier in this week, we're just talking about the Book of Esther. Esther herself gets in drag. Like she gets really dressed up when she goes to her husband. It's a very naughty book as well, like the Golden Scepter, all that kind of stuff. Like it's drag-esque. It's meant to be about dressing up, characterizing and going to the extremes. So it kind of links in, I think, with what Lev's saying, but that kind of personal thing of like trying to break my boundaries as well, I really enjoy doing.
I also think this blue wig is very fabulous on you.
Isn't it? It's my first ever wig I've bought. I've got loads of others. And this, yeah, it's a good one. Thank you for the compliment. I'll take it. It suits me. I know.
The thing what I love in a community setting is being able to see Like, what we're not very good at is just that sort of, oh, we're here to party, you know, the opposite kind of vibe of what Lev is describing. But what people are very good at is seeing what they can get away with, like how naughty they can be, what they can say in their shul community in the guise of, well, I'm just being a bit disruptive because it's Purim and that's what we're meant to do. But actually how far they can push the, oh, I've said that and I've got it off my chest. And you know, going along with that, sort of the, you know, including in the Maariv and the evening service before the Megillah reading, Kaddish, the memorial prayer, and including specifically all those people that we're actually quite secretly glad are no longer with us in our lives. you know, the sorts of things you'd never say, but kind of, you know, holding those little, those bits that, that, you know, just push the envelope a little bit of what's appropriate in public society.
That is pushing the boundaries. Love it.
Do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. Finchley Reform Synagogue, FRS, is great fun at Purim. That was when I started to really enjoy Purim. Lots of shots being passed around. And you had a theme one year that where people had to dress as their favourite or worst part of the building, which is now gone, and you're getting a new building. And someone came dressed as the toilets, which I thought was brilliant. And it's quite cathartic, isn't it, being able to dress up in that way and say things that maybe you wouldn't. Or
we have tried to do theme it around where the community's at any one point, so that just before the building got knocked down. And we did one year where it was all themed around people's favorite Radio 4 programs. How to be funny but keep it where people are at.
I had forgotten, it's just come back to me, that my parents used to make quite a lot of effort to team dress up.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And I have these fantastic memories now that I'm remembering it of. I mean, we used to do this for parties at home as well, but there was one year, and I don't know if there was a circus theme at shul. I think maybe there was. They went as the guys who clean up the elephant poop after the elephants have gone through. They both had like these blue boiler suits and buckets and sweeping things and mops. And like, it was so ridiculous and brilliant. And I think it's such a great opportunity for everyone to be silly, right? We don't go to shul to be silly a lot of the time. And it's so wonderful to see people let their hair down and be ridiculous. And also sort of see people's sense of humour and where that's at.
I've had a wonderful time in previous years. While at the college, I've been Lily Montague, who's the founder of Liberal Judaism, and done exactly what Miriam said and really used it as a chance to sort of have digs at my own religious community and make fun of my own religiosity. I've come as Amy Winehouse, and I'm not sure what I'm going to be this year.
I remember wandering around at the Sternberg Centre 11, bumping into you on Purim, dressed as a drag version of the Torah, which is one of my favourite Purim costumes ever. It was like a Torah scroll with breasts and hair and gorgeousness.
Oh, wow.
That's right. I lived with the seamstress who actually made from velvet a proper full-on Torah mantle for me to wear. I'd forgotten that one. And also my earliest memory, I think, which like I put this down to, if anyone was going to guess when it was that I was gay, this is like a great time. It's when I was about 8, Dana International won the Eurovision Song Contest for Israel, and the whole of UK Jewry, probably worldwide Jewry, was thrilled that this trans woman was succeeding for the Jews. And I went as Dana to that next Purim and was just, I think that's one of the reasons why I fell in love with Purim, is its ability to enable me to be more and more homosexual every year.
I think we might have reached peak, Lev.
Absolutely. I think we need to
that
ask
sounds
producer-
like a challenge.
A challenge.
We need to ask producer Dan to make sure there's photos attached in the program notes for this, because I definitely want to see the drag Torah. So whatever masks that you wear in your day-to-day life and however you celebrated this Purim, I hope that as we move into this new chapter in this year ahead, you will find your role models and keep pushing those boundaries and make sure that you stand against the crowds whenever you need to. So as always, we love hearing from you, and someone will always reply to you. So do get in touch with us by emailing media@rjuk.org. And if you'd like to ask a question to one of us or suggest a topic that you'd like us to ponder, then you can message us on WhatsApp or even record a voice note and send it to 07922 575 583. I definitely think we need a jingle to remember that number because it is definitely not catchy.
When we're talking about all these messages, and it was like, I think over the last few weeks particularly, we've received some really incredible messages, and not just saying, you know, thanks, we love to listen, which obviously we love hearing from, thank you to our parents and cousins and fans, but actually people who are listening all around the world who get in touch to tell us about their journeys and what has touched them and to ask questions. And I think it's been so wonderful to receive those messages. So I want to say thank you to people for taking the time to write and be in touch.
Absolutely. A huge thank you for making it a two-way dialogue between not just us, but with our listeners as well. And a massive thank you to Lev for joining us today.
Thank you. It's been wonderful.
Enhancing our Purim edition. And we will enjoy walking your rabbinic journey with you as well, and making sure that you're always bringing flamboyance and joy into the rabbinate. Nice to see you all. Bye.
Bye. Happy Purim.
Bye.
Goodbye. Rabbit on.